And Daniel Pinchbeck with us. This hour we'll take your phone calls. How soon is now? That's the name of his latest book. Okay, George Norrie back with you along with Daniel Pinchbeck. He is live in Germany right now. His book, soon to be released, How Soon Is Now? And we're going to take your calls this hour. It's our final hour here with Daniel. Daniel, Elon Musk, the expert, the inventor of Tesla, he thinks that we're living in a virtual reality, that we're not even in a real live situation. That's kind of weird, but what do you think of that?
Well, I mean, you know, once again, psychedelic experiences through ayahuasca and dimethyltryptamine or DMT, you know, seem to indicate there are many levels and layers to reality. You know, and you know, now many scientists talk about different dimensions of space-time, that, you know, this space-time would actually be totally from a higher dimension, something almost like a, you know, something you could walk around or walk through or something. So yeah, I mean, that idea that it's a simulation, like a computer simulation, is possible. I don't think it absolves us of our responsibility to like alleviate suffering and deal with our situation and so on. But you know, it's also very similar to what the Eastern philosophy talks about, like the idea of the Maya, is that this is kind of like a divine play or an illusion that's maintained by the creative power of the gods, you know. So yeah, there may be many, many levels, even infinite levels, but I do think it's wonderful that even very technically minded engineering and physics people are now coming up with ideas that seem very close to these kind of mystical conceptions from these esoteric traditions.
As you look at the planet as a whole, who seems to be, in terms of countries, the ones way out in the forefront to do many of the things that you recommend and How Soon Is Now?
Well, I mean, you know, the Scandinavian countries and you know, Germany to some extent seem to be countries where, you know, most of the people are at a fairly high standard of living. And I mean, you know, Iceland was I believe, the country that threw out the bankers, you know, and I think they did an experiment where they had people writing a new constitution online, you know, yeah, and then I also think that we can learn a lot from indigenous people and traditional societies, you know, that were, you know, a lot of those societies didn't even have concepts of private property or ownership until it was forced on them by the modern world. And, you know, we have to sort of, as I said, step back and look at the historical evolution of a lot of ideas and recognize that a lot of things that we believe are, you know, immutable and real are actually just kind of, you know, a recent ideas, human efforts, and maybe we'll need to change them again and create something quite different.
It was said that absolute power corrupts absolutely. What's going to happen in the future with that?
Well, I mean, you know, I think that Trump represents a deep systemic crisis in American society. You know, America has always been a country that hasn't really, you know, that's had very high-minded ideals on the one hand, but has also been responsible for a lot of destruction around the world. I mean, we've you know, gotten, you know, we've you know, taken down democratically elected governments in other countries, you know, because, you know, we were concerned about them. I mean, we've done a lot of, you know, dirty things around the world. And in a way, now I think that this is a reckoning, you know, what we want to be as a society. You know, do we want to actually, you know, kind of finally manifest those great ideals that we see in people like Martin Luther King and, you know, Jefferson and so on, or do we want to just, you know, go into a kind of abyss, you know, of authoritarian control and, you know, kind of corporate fascism?
We could go either way, I guess,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to the phones now as they wait. Cincinnati, Ohio, Mark, east of the Rockies, you're on with Daniel Pinchbeck. Go ahead, Mark.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Daniel.
Hi there.
I just noticed how far left Daniel leans, and I don't mean to start any argument or anything. I just wanted to note that all of this hostility is not coming from the right. It's not coming from Trump supporters. It's coming from the left, and only the left. And it's kind of like it's not seen by anybody. And I wondered, why do you think that might be? And you have a great morning.
All right. Thank you, Daniel. Go ahead. You're more than welcome to react to that.
It's funny because I've been hearing that a lot. But I mean, for instance, like, you know, I read a piece recently by a, you know, a more liberal woman who, you know, put up a piece online. I mean, this has happened to all sorts of people and got a lot of death threats. The university that she worked for, you know, got people calling and, you know, saying that, you know, and so it, for me, it seems that the excessive hostility is actually coming from the right, but the right is obsessed with this idea that the liberals and the left are the hostile ones. And, you know, clearly we're in a very fraught time where a lot of nerves are bare, you know, but you know, from what I can see, the right wing, you know, is tilting in a direction that you know, leads to kind of suppression of free speech and using trolling online and so on, and calling people and you know, threatening them and so on. I don't remember that happening to conservatives from liberals. I just don't remember that happening.
I think part of the problem, Daniel, is that I think some of the violence that's occurring from what they call the left really is coming from people who are underprivileged and don't have futures. They may not even have jobs. They're younger kids who go out and loot, rob, break windows when they protest and demonstrate. Most older folks who are leaning toward the left don't go out and do that.
Towards the right, you mean?
Yeah, or yeah. Both ways.
Yeah, but on the other hand,
older people don't go out and break windows.
And, you know, shooting, like, it wasn't the recent shooting in Canada with, like, what turned out to be a white supremacist who opened fire on, you know, so.
Yeah, but he was a young guy.
Yeah.
And that's my point. Yeah. These younger people are the ones that are, you know, promoting the violence.
But I do think there's like a more subconscious thing going on where, you know, for instance, I've been going to this festival called the Burning Man Festival,
right,
where a lot of wealthy kind of progressives, liberals, but also like entrepreneurs and tech company CEOs and financiers have been going for years. And I began to feel, at first I was really inspired by it on so many levels, but over time I began to feel that it was becoming more and more insular. And so I feel that there's a lot of like kind of, you know, progress of certain types, but also sort of hedonistic abandon and opportunity that's happening in elites, you know, on the coasts and so on. But the middle of the country recognized that they weren't really invited to the party, and actually their lives were getting kind of worse and more grim, and the types of, you know, jobs that people had in the 50s and 60s weren't around anymore. So I think that there is legitimacy, you know, for this increasing frustration and.
Not an excuse to burn, loot, and rob.
No, not an excuse to do that. You know, but it's not an excuse to do that, of course. But you know, we also don't know who is. You know, there's also been cases where, you know, intelligence agencies have had, you know, kind of instigators in protests, you know, who've caused damage.
Oh, sure. I mean,
that's not out of the question either.
And George Soros has financed some of those too.
Well, I wouldn't go that far to say that I know that. I mean, I know there are now certain figures in the culture who've become kind of flashpoints for a lot of, you know, anger and resentment. I mean, you know, I don't know everything about George Soros, but, you know, I think, you know, some of the things that he's tried to do with, you know, ending the war on drugs and creating more open societies, you know, are quite positive. But once again, I think still this underlying thing that we're reliant on these billionaire philanthropists to kind of choose the direction of society for us is not right, and there needs to be a much deeper democratization of wealth and power. What I advocate for in the book would be, yeah, kind of like community movements. You know, like in Spain, there's one called Podemos, and you know, potentially the internet. You know, if you look at something like the blockchain, which is a kind of system that you know is the underlying support for the for Bitcoin, you know, the cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
You know, the blockchain could be used, for instance, to have a clean democracy, you know, that scales from like local to bioregional to global, you know, scale, so that everybody actually did have a voice and didn't just have to vote. I mean, I think it's very frustrating to only be able to vote like once every 4 years for one of two candidates who maybe both are not really what you believe in. But we could have a system where people are able to exercise their, you know, kind of voice continuously. You know, they could pay attention to issues. They could have votes on, in different issues or proxy their votes. You know, I'm hoping that what we can now see is really a crisis in our democratic system. And once again, we have to think about how, you know, this government that we have now was something that was built in the 18th century when everything moved much slower, you know, and you know, it wasn't really designed at a time when we have the internet, when people can communicate instantaneously, you know, and it wasn't really, yeah, it wasn't really designed to deal with the speed of change that we're seeing around the world now. You know, so a big question is whether we're going to move towards, you know, more participatory democracy or less. You know, and I think that's a choice that we as a human collective have to make.
G is with us from Hilo, Hawaii. Hello, G. Welcome to the program.
Aloha, George.
You too. Thank you.
And we appreciate your show last night.
That's right, on Hawaii. It was a great program.
Yes, your guest is dead on so many things. I just wanted to throw in there something he's kind of already mentioned, that the answers are all around us. We just need to look to the past. As the old Hawaiian culture here stressed, Malama the Aina, Mauka the Makai, and the earth will heal itself. So I think people just need to think outside the box. Anything is possible. And like you said, George, all the time, we have all the technology right now to make the changes.
We sure do.
And here in Hawaii, we already have mandate to go on 100% renewable energy to produce electricity. So the state government here is at least doing something in that direction. But, you know, the answers are already here. You just have to wake up.
You're right on, G. There's no doubt about that. Daniel, he's spot on.
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially the perspective in my book, How Soon Is Now. I mean, you know, there are some areas that, I mean, and you know, although I'm kind of advocating, you know, for, in a sense, you know, localization, you know, but kind of almost like a global effort towards localization. You know, I'm not a Luddite. Like, I think we need to use the tools that we have, although I'm very suspicious of, you know, these corporate kind of futuristic technology ideas. Like, for instance, geoengineering, you know, by putting sulfur particles in the upper atmosphere. You know, I think interventions in the Earth system like that are liable to have even more negative effects. As the caller just said, you know, the you know, we can learn from nature. The tools are already here. You know, the earth can heal herself. You know, if we support that process consciously and intelligently, which we're not doing at this point.
Dana is in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hello, Dana. Welcome to the program. You're up with us.
Hi, George. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Daniel, I'm going to say this with all due respect, okay? So I don't want you to think I'm beating up on you, but all I've heard was Trump. You accused that man of going to start a war. You accused him of all kinds of things, but you said nothing about the past 8 years and the devastation that Obama has caused, utter chaos. You talk science, but then you don't want to use that science to judge the previous president. This guy's been in office barely 3 weeks. You've got him you have him starting another war. So I have an issue with that. The other issue I have is the only science you guys are in, I would be more respectful of you if you would be honest and be forthright. I don't care that people have differing opinions. That's what makes the world go round. But be forthright about it. The fact of the matter is, the Pope hosted a climate symposium, I believe it was a couple of years ago, and armed guards refused to let any opposition to the things that you're saying into that symposium, as all client symposiums, or anyone purporting the theory of cows eating less meat and cows putting methane in the air. You refuse to have an open and honest debate with scientists who are as credentialed as the scientists who are proposing the other side. These people have graduated from the Ivy Leagues and some of the top colleges and universities around the globe, but you guys will not debate them. You always say, well, 99%...
Can I speak, though?
Yes, but I'm. Let me get this one last thing out. You always say this is what the climate people who are saying we're having all these problems. 99% or 97% of all scientists agree. Well, how many scientists are there? Nobody will ever give us the total number to see if it's 97, because it isn't 97 or 99. You
Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, thank you. So a number of things. I mean, I personally was not a fan of the Obama administration. I feel that he betrayed the promises that he made to the people. When he was elected in 2008, he had a massive volunteer kind of army behind him of people who wanted to change the you know, America for the better. He really abandoned them, and he ended up being very top-down and managerial. You know, he ended up supporting, you know, military operations in the Middle East. You know, wealth inequality increased. You know, I mean, you know, I don't think he's totally bad, but, you know, I definitely feel that, you know, he was like empire with a soft power face. You know, and now we have, you know, empire with a hard power, you know, kind of attitude, a very, very naked attitude. You know, and Trump has simply said things like, you know, we want to go to, you know, let's go to Iraq and take that oil. Let's just grab the oil. I mean, he said a lot of very aggressive things, and he's put in his cabinet a lot of, you know, hawkish people that suggest that he's going to follow through on military operations, you know. And you know, you can look through the whole, anyway, so, you know, and in terms of the science, I don't know who you mean by you people. I'm just me. I'm not like I don't represent some echelon of whatever. But, you know, from my reading and my study, which I tried to be impartial about, the evidence is very, very good. I mean, if you look around the world, we have factories, we have jet planes, we have cars. You know, we're belching CO2. We're putting a million tons of CO2 into the atmosphere every hour. You know, the atmosphere is a fairly narrow sheath of you know certain miles of height and so on. And we can measure. You know, we know that when there was a stable climate, there was 275 parts per million, and now there's more than 400. And we know from studying the past that when there was this much CO2, temperatures become 4 degrees Celsius warmer, you know, sea levels rise and so on. And we do know that, you know, these other statistics that I brought about, I mean, nobody's arguing against ocean acidification. You know, the oceans are 30% more acidic than they were 40 years ago, which is leading to the breakdown of the world's coral reefs. And that's happening because the entire body of the ocean is absorbing the excess CO2 that we're producing, like giant lungs, you know, which is also pretty scary, because at some point they may start to emit it like lungs, which would even increase climate change faster. You know, I know that it's very hard for many people to accept. And the other problem is, you know, there's a very well-funded group of fossil fuel lobbies who, you know, there's like, you know, $50 trillion of what could be stranded assets. It's estimated that the fossil fuel companies have on their books, you know, that if we don't drill, you know, they're called them stranded assets, because if we drill them, we know that the climate will become unlivable. You know, so they're protecting a huge economic boondoggle, and they're doing that, you know, by creating disinformation. You know, I mean, one of the ideas that I look at in the book is, you know, corporations, you know, are kind of artificial life forms. And we created a game called the stock market. And we tell the corporations that the only way they can survive is to maximize shareholder value. You know, so that's what they're doing. So if they have to create disinformation or evade, you know, environmental restrictions or corrupt governments, that's what they do. But the problem is in the design that we've created. So we actually need to step back and see why this is malfunctioning and why it's destructive. And we need to figure out how we redesign the game machinery so corporations are not just profit motive ventures, that are also seeking to, you know, replenish the earth system, you know, restore the health of local communities and so on.
All right, Daniel, we're going to come back and take some final phone calls with you right here on Coast to Coast AM. Great programs for the rest of the week for you here on Coast to Coast AM. A.J. Foyt, 82 years old now. He has been one of the greatest race car drivers everywhere, but his body has been literally beaten down over the years. Surgery, heart surgery, knees, hips, all kinds of issues. Now he's looking for the fountain of youth. He's going to undergo stem cell therapy in Cancun, Mexico. I hope it works for him. And welcome back to Coast. Daniel Pinchbeck with us. We're going to take your final calls in a second. Some of the things you've recommended, Daniel, are doable, I think, for a lot of people. But, you know, one, you're saying give up your car. That's going to be tough for a lot of people.
No. I mean, I'm more saying that you know, what I guess the idea that I would propose would be that if we were to start to take the ecological crisis seriously, you know, we would then have to create a movement around how to deal with that. And obviously, people don't give up their cars or their homes or anything like that. But you know, ultimately, we would need to have reductions in the resources that we're using. And I would see this as not being something that's forced from above, but be voluntary. You know, so for instance, like let's say you had a web platform. Let's say Facebook or some or Google or somebody did a campaign where it's like, okay, like you know. Would you be willing to reduce meat because you know it has a beneficial impact on the environment? You know, so like, you know, would you, you know, eat meat once a week or once a month? You know, and would 1 million people agree to do that? And here's the benefits it would have. You know, here's what it would do to deforestation. Here's what it would do to CO2. You know, here's what it would do to species extinction. And I think a lot of people would say, yeah, like I would prefer. I mean, I think people aren't really been asked to do anything. There's no sense of like shared sacrifice. And I think if people were asked to do things, you know, for and they really understood that it was authentically for, you know, the future, for their own children and descendants, they would do it. You know, if there was a longer range plan, if we were saying like, this is how we want our society to be, like we want to, you know, we recognize that automation is not stoppable, you know, so we're not going to have these types of manufacturing jobs as much anymore, you know, but people will have a basic income so they can live in comfortably, they can learn, they can have the time to cultivate their unique, being and so on, you know, the time to be with their families and so on. You know, I think it is a really different model that's called for to deal with this, and it's beyond what we've even started to discuss in the political arena. And I'm really hoping that the book, you know, as a radical, you know, offering, you know, will sort of, you know, make people think, like, why does it have to be this way? Maybe we just haven't been using our imagination, you know, of how our society could be. We've been locked in certain ideas of how it has to be. You know, so I'm hoping the book will create a new dialogue around what our direction could be.
So some people, I don't think, are doing these things because I don't think they think we're at a desperate stage yet. Are we?
Well, I mean, once again, it's a question of whether or not you want to, you know, think that the scientists have truth. I mean, if you look at the, you know, I mean, the amount of forest fires around the world, you know, the Indonesia, like all their forests gone around the Northwest, you know, the droughts in California, and you know, it's like, yeah, I mean, you know, the levels of species extinction. I mean, concerns about the methane under the Arctic, these huge deposits of frozen methane under the Siberian peat frost, that can bring about another like 3 to 4 Celsius temperature rise. I mean, you know, once again, that woman was like, oh, you know, there are a few scientists who disagree. What are the numbers? But, you know, from what I've read from almost every kind of, you know, authoritative source, you know, we're in a huge ecological crisis. And it's going to be a focus for the future. Like, we're going to, at some point, if we want to continue as a species, I mean, you know, the forests around the world produce 20% of the oxygen that we breathe, you know, so as we burn them down, we're running lower on oxygen. You know, the plankton in the oceans produce more than 50% of the oxygen we breathe. You know, if the methane erupts and temperatures go, you know, 5 degrees Celsius warmer, you know, then the plankton stops producing oxygen and we asphyxiate. And we know there have been times in the past, like the Permian mass extinction, 95% of all life on Earth went extinct in a relatively, you know, brief period. You know, so yeah, we can use our intelligence, we can redesign our systems, you know, we can, you know, really have a movement that recognizes that we're one human family, we're like a giant organism, a planetary superorganism, and that, you know, like the cells of a body, we should all work together to make this thing work for everybody.
It was a story that broke a week ago. A federal scientist apparently cooked climate change books ahead of an Obama presentation. According to a whistleblower, he kicked aside information that showed a slowdown in global warming. So you don't know sometimes who to believe, Daniel.
Well, once again, I mean, then you'd have to look into, you know, who was behind the leak. I mean, you know,
sure. And who was the whistleblower?
But so, you know, so you know, we sort of have to use the evidence of our senses here a little bit too. I mean, when my mother was a girl, you know, she could walk across the Hudson River, you know, in the winters at times. You know, when I was a child, you know, sometimes you could walk across pools in Central Park. You know, now that freezing really never happens. You know, the winter in New York, you know, is much more temperate than it was. You know, plants are changing the way they bloom. You know, species, I mean, there's all this evidence, you know, species are changing their range as the climate, you know, mosquitoes are moving north, you know, like, I mean, you know, these huge changes are being, you know, charted, you know, huge amounts of them all over the planet. The data is overwhelming, you know, so whatever these other little stories are basically, I think for the most part, efforts of the fossil fuel lobby to continue to plant seeds of doubt and confusion, you know, so, and, you know, I mean, and Rex Tillerson, you know, the Exxon Secretary of State, you know, he's also, you know, if you go back to his past statements, like, he knows climate change is happening, and he says that, you know, oh, you know, yeah, climate change is happening, but people just adapt. You know, well, it's easy to adapt, you know, to changes, you know, if you're worth $300 million and have houses, you know, all over the world.
With great air conditioning.
If you're a Bangladesh, a peasant in Bangladesh who lives at 0 to 5 meters above sea level, you know, India has created a huge fence to keep them out, knowing there's going to be masses of environmental refugees. You know, what do you do when seawater has reached your freshwater and you can't grow your crops anymore? I mean, that's the circumstance for millions and millions of people around the world. And we in the developed world are actually responsible for that. It's our excess use of CO2, our mass consumption habits that are actually, you know, have caused this degradation of the environment the most. And we should man up and say, okay, like, we're going to take care of the situation. You know, we created it. We're going to go into service mode, and we're going to, you know, do what it takes to reverse this destruction.
The solar system is warming up, so other planets are getting hotter too. So we could also be in Earth cycles. And I think a lot of people, Daniel, get confused between climate change and pollution. And I can't think of anybody who's in favor of pollution other than huge corporations that continue to dump stuff.
I mean, you know, so I think climate change has become confusing for people for all these reasons and the amount of disinformation. But there's a model from a group called the Stockholm Resilience Center called the Planetary Boundaries Model. And they have 9 markers of changes that are happening. And it includes things, yeah, like atmospheric pollution, ozone depletion, nitrogen runoff from industrial agriculture, you know, and species extinction, which is one of the main ones, ocean acidification. You know, so if you don't want to believe that global warming is caused by industry, which I think is pretty obvious that it is, you know, you can go and look at all the other factors that suggest that we're really creating a, you know, hellish situation for ourselves. Or you can just look around at the Superfund sites, at, you know, at the huge ghettos and huge cities and so on, and you can draw your own conclusions.
Let's go to Mike, truck driving in North Carolina, first-time caller. Michael, thank you, and welcome to the program.
Yes, how are you doing today?
Great.
Look, thank you, George. I'm glad you took my call, and I'll make it real short.
Okay,
I almost
sir.
Made it to Asheville to see your thing.
Ah, you would have liked it. You would have had fun.
I had a conflicting schedule. But anyway, what I wanted to say was, Daniel, you're very smart, and I like a lot of things you're saying, and I believe what you're saying. But one thing you need to do, if you want to be a more likable person, is leave my president out of it, leave the politics out of it, and I think we'll be okay. And I'm a truck driver, by the way. I've been doing this for 44 years, and please leave my truck drivers out of this, because if it weren't for a truck, you wouldn't get what you need when you need it, when you're not in the bushes or the woods, or you're having your psychic experiences. So I'm just saying, I appreciate what you're doing for us, and you're very smart, and I believe in most of what you're saying. But just leave my president out of this and the politics, and you'll be okay. George, God bless you.
Okay. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Mike.
Let's go next to Scott in Edgewood, Washington, on the wild card line. Scotty, go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi there.
Wonderful show, as usual.
Thank you.
And it's right up my alley. One of the things that I've been preaching for the last 30 years is that we need to change the way we do things on this planet. And one of the major problems is population. We either figure out how to gracefully reduce our population, or Mother Nature is going to do it for us. And one of the things that I've always thought we should probably do is take one of those areas of the planet that is like totally inhospitable and learn how to live there. Because if we can do that, we'll survive it. And
like the terraform the desert or something like that, huh?
Right. So, like Western Sahara. You know, Western Sahara is like sand, sun, and a little bit of surf on the west edge. If you can learn how to make that work, we'll probably survive what's coming.
Well, I like what you said about a way to make populations go down gracefully. I mean, you know, the biggest problem from my perspective is not population. It's it's kind of the inefficient use of resources. You know, so like, you know, if you have people in like, you know, who are living, you know, like the Kogi Indians who live in the mountains of Colombia, they're totally self-sufficient. They basically use no, you know, excess CO2, no consumer goods and so on. They make their own clothes. I mean, people can live like that, you know, and so it's really about our use of resources, our consumption patterns and so on. But, you know, even so, yes, probably we're beginning to reach a level at which we need to reduce population. But actually, the way to do that is actually, believe it or not, to empower women in society. In societies where women approach equality with men in terms of their access to, you know, financial gain and careers and so on and educational opportunities, the birth rates actually start to decline naturally because women don't want to have so many kids when they have their own choice in the matter, you know. So that's, you know, one thing. And the other thing is that, you know, I don't think that there are certain things that are going to be preventable. Like, we're probably not going to be able to prevent sea level rise of a significant amount to the point where many of our coastal cities ultimately are flooded out, you know. But, you know, even if we were to have 100-foot sea level rise, you know, that would only eliminate 5% of the land surface on the Earth. There actually would still be plenty of room for human beings to live. We would have to create new settlements, eco-villages, eco-cities. You know, apparently you could resettle the entire population of the planet to Texas, and people would still have room for backyards, you know. So it's a big planet, and the problem is really, you know, our inefficient and destructive consumption patterns.
A lot of people live on the coast, though, Daniel. We lose those coasts. It could be a mess.
Well, it's certainly going to be a mess. I mean, it's already, you know, I think that a mess is not avoidable at this point. And what I'm really hoping to do with the book is offer an alternative for where, you know, how we kind of approach the situation, you know, which would be towards like, okay, like this is our initiation. Like, that's one thing. Like, you know, the ecological movement is usually always like, oh, you know, it's just terrible, it's going to be a disaster. But let's say, like, you know, and actually, if you look at history in times that are difficult, you know, there are often people rise to the occasion and they're remembered afterwards as like the greatest times in history. You know, like England during the Second World War, you know, how they rallied to fight the Nazis and take care of each other, you know. One of the books I talk about in my book is by this woman, Rebecca Solnit, who went all around the world to disaster areas and found out that people actually remembered these disasters as great moments because they all came together and they broke out of their egos and their, you know, competitive careerist goals, and they actually just wanted to help each other. So I think that humans actually have a deep natural altruism that our society kind of almost doesn't make us aware of, in a way.
Tim in Albany, New York. Hello, Tim. Welcome to the program. Go ahead, Tim.
Hi, morning. I got a question. Where's the money coming for everybody to stay home? The salaries
that's a good question.
Give everybody a salary?
Well, I mean, you know, first of all, I mean, I think, you know, we need to think about what our money system is and how it works. You know, what we have now is a fiat currency that's controlled by, you know, private banking interests, you know, who have these, you know, like the Federal Reserve is neither federal or reserve, you know, and we saw it with the 2008 financial crash that, you know, all these people lost their homes, but rather than, you know, helping them out, you know, the bankers subsidized the banks and, you know, then took bonuses off of that, you know. So you know, the financial system that we have now is actually not very fair. You can almost talk about it in computer language as kind of like corrupted source code, you know. So you know, could there be other ways that we exchange value, you know, other tools for doing that? I mean, in the book I talk about, this economist, Bernard Lyotard, who was one of the people who came up with the euro, who suggested we could have like a negative interest currency, you know, that, you know, doesn't allow for hoarding, you know, so people have to share it when they get it. You know, another model is local exchange trading systems. There's a book by this guy called Tom Greco called The End of Money and the Future of Civilization, where he argues that if you have like service providers, manufacturers, farms, they can actually come together and they can issue their own zero interest credit to other people or organizations or businesses. You know, so, you know, once again, like, we haven't really used our imagination. We think that this type of money is the only type that exists. But then we're already seeing, you know, some very interesting experiments like Bitcoin, is a cryptocurrency that's based on very complex mathematical formula that can only, and it's organized in such a way that can only be 21 million Bitcoin. So in a way, it's backed by mathematics, you know, which is almost more than what's backing.
Boy, China just pulled out though and crushed it.
What's that?
China pulled out.
Bitcoin has been going up a lot, and it's only the first. You know, there's many other cryptocurrencies in formation. I mean, in a way, you could look at Bitcoin, you know, and yes, it's going to have perturbations. It's a new thing.
Ah, I just like cash. Daniel, we're out of time. Thank you so much. How soon is now? Daniel Pinchback. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.